The 1999 murder of Haman Lee in Baltimore, Maryland, and the prosecution and conviction of Adnan Syed and her murder has now been documented in multiple podcasts with dozens and dozens of episodes. It's been written about in hundreds of articles. It's been covered by every major news outlet and has launched a global movement for justice. And yet, there is much more to the story, including Adnan's own telling of it. St. Martin's Press brings you Adnan's Story, Murder, Justice, and the Case That Captivated a Nation, the first and seminal book about the case that I was honored to write with contributions from Adnan himself. The book releases September 6, 2016, but is already available for pre-order. Go to www.adnanstory.com to place your order and reserve your copy today. This week's episode of Undisclosed is brought to you by Stamps.com. Going to the post office is so old school. It is such a hassle taking trips there. I know because every time I go, I get stuck for at least half an hour. That's why over 600,000 small businesses are already using Stamps.com to get postage right from their desks whenever they need it, 24 hours a day. You know you can't do that at the post office. Stamps.com turns your printer and computer into a virtual post office. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package. Stamps.com is a better way to do your mailing and shipping. It's easy to use, it's convenient, and it lets you focus your time where you want, on growing your business, instead of spending your time taking trips to the post office. No wonder $2.6 billion in postage was printed just last year alone using Stamps.com. Right now, if you sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code undisclosed for this special offer, you're going to get a 4-week trial and $110 in bonuses, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in undisclosed. That's Stamps.com and enter undisclosed. Hi and welcome to a special episode of Undisclosed. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I blog at splitthemoon.com. My colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller are not going to be with me this week, but don't worry, they'll be back next week. Now, last year, I was invited to a fundraising and award event hosted by an organization called the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, based out of Washington, D.C. I wasn't just invited to the event, though. They actually wanted to honor me with an award. And I have to be honest, I was confused at first, and I didn't immediately realize why they wanted to recognize me. I mean, I had never done any activism on the issue of youth sentencing in the criminal justice system. Then I realized it was because of my work on Adnan's case, and I also realized that I had never really given any thought to the issue of him being sentenced as a juvenile because, in my mind, his case was always about this really flawed investigation, about bigotry, and about a wrongful conviction. His sentence was abhorrent, for sure, but that was because I believed he was innocent. I never really connected the issue of unconscionable sentencing of criminal youth offenders to Adnan's case because in my mind, he wasn't an offender. But I went to the event and I came away feeling deeply ashamed for never having given this issue the consideration that it deserves. But I also came away inspired by the work that the campaign does and the people that I met there. The story of one man in particular who was also honored that night stayed with me long after I left. Xavier McElrath Bay, a 40-year-old man who had been convicted of first-degree murder at the age of 13, was honored for his work on youth sentencing and giving youth offenders hope at a new life. But Xavier was actually being honored by his peers because he works for the campaign as a youth justice advocate, and he's also the founder of an organization called ICAN, the Incarcerated Children's Advocacy Network. The policy and advocacy work of ICAN and the campaign are both important, but the stories of the people at the heart of the issue of youth sentencing are even more so. It is both a pleasure and a deep honor for me to introduce our listeners to Xavier, a tremendous human being with an incredible story.
My name is Xavier, and I'm from Chicago, Illinois. I have a bachelor's degree in social science and a master of arts in counseling and human services from Roosevelt University. I do work mostly with at-risk youth, youth who have either been incarcerated or are on the way to being incarcerated, because I feel like I can relate to them and they can relate to me. I feel like no matter how much I give back, I can never make up for the things that I've done. So for me, I feel like it's a life mission. I know that my goal of reaching out and helping these kids is never going to end.
Hi, Xavier. I want to start by thanking you for joining us today on Undisclosed.
I'm happy to be here.
You know, I mean, I know you're really busy, and it took quite a while for us to coordinate us speaking. I mean, I think we've been kind of trying to work at it since last year. And I know our listeners on Undisclosed are really going to be interested in hearing your story, which is where I would like to start today, if that's okay with you. If you could just tell us a little bit, just tell us a little bit about your background, where you were raised.
Well, I was raised in the South Side of Chicago, in Back of the Yards. The area that I lived in, I guess you can say, was similar to a lot of Chicago communities back in the 70s and 80s. Very poor, disinvested, just really crime and gang-infested community that I grew up in was, I guess, typical for a lot of kids growing up, unfortunately, in Chicago at that time.
You know, when I first met you and learned of your story, I was really shocked to hear that you were actually incarcerated very young. Can you talk a little bit about that and your interactions with really the criminal justice system since childhood?
Well, at 13 years old, I stood in front of a judge and I was being charged with first-degree murder. At the time, I was very visibly a child. But unfortunately, when I was tried as an adult, that was not important in the eyes of the court. I had a state's attorney who believed very strongly that I was irredeemable. I'll never forget, he wrote in a statement of facts, he said that the defendant has an extensive juvenile arrest record indicative of a violent nature, and under no circumstances should be considered for early release. And that was the way in which I was portrayed in the courtroom. And that was mostly because I had 19 arrests and 7 convictions. Many offenses were violence, armed robberies, aggravated assaults, multiple weapon charges, mostly gang-related and violent offenses. At that time in particular, when there was such a high rate of crime and murder in the city of Chicago, it was a time in which they were, you know, almost automatically sentencing children under the adult sentencing schemes that unfortunately did not take into consideration youthfulness, didn't take into consideration the fact that we were children. The state's attorney in my case wanted to give me 40 years in prison. My co-defendant, who was 14 years old, was given 40 years. He went to trial, was found guilty. As for myself, I didn't go to trial. I decided to plead guilty. I was guilty. I was remorseful. And I sort of put my life in the hands of my public defender. And her name was Hershella Conyers. She was 3 years as a public defender. Good heart. Really just a very strong advocate for me. And, you know, when you're so used to going into prison or going into detention and standing in front of the judge and, you know, being given consequences, you know, without consideration to the life that you had lived, you know, you just sort of assume, you know, that it's, you're going to receive the worst of the worst. And she was not having it. They tried to convince her to talk me into a 40-year sentencing plea deal. She went to conference. She spoke with the state's attorney, the judge, was in there for quite a time. I was waiting in the bullpen. And during that time I was waiting in the bullpen, I remember I was pacing back and forth. I remember I was sweating. My heart was pounding. I was so anxious.
At this time, had your co-defendant already been sentenced?
Yes, he was already sentenced to 40 years at the time. Yes.
Okay.
Because I had 19 arrests and 7 convictions and he had only one prior arrest and one conviction, it was really a no-brainer that I should have received more time than him. But I was fortunate to have a strong advocate, like I said, and Hershel Conyers talked him down to 25 years under the old law, which gave the opportunity to earn good time. I could have been out of prison after 12 and a half years, which meant for every good day served, it would be one day taken off my time, so to speak. And because I was able to, you know, for the most part, in the later years, stay out of trouble and earn back some of the time I lost, I was released from prison after 13 years.
I want to back up just a little bit because I'm interested in something that you kind of started off with, what you were talking about your upbringing and talking about the fact that as sentencing is happening in these cases, a lot of times mitigating factors like your background and what's happened in the past are not taken into consideration. But at the same time, you said that by the time you were standing in front of a judge at 13, you already had 19 arrests. So can you talk a little bit about how a 13-year-old ends up with 19 arrests?
You know, it's funny. You know, I'm 40 years old today, and, you know, I have a 4-year-old daughter. I have a nephew who's around that age now. He just turned 13, in fact. And for me to really just think about my past, it's really hard for me to imagine that a 13-year-old could have done so much. But I do remember very vividly some of the circumstances that I had endured as a child. I do remember the extreme poverty that I had to contend with along with my family. I remember, you know, our family really being reliant upon services in our community. My mother often shopped at Salvation Army. My stepfather at that time And I'm talking about around 8 and a half, 9, 10. My stepfather had a very serious drinking problem, and that continued on for many years. In fact, that particular time was very violent in my home because he would often go, he would work long hours in the factory and back of the yards, and he would come home and he would retire to his room. But on Friday nights, he wouldn't come home. He would instead go to the neighborhood bar, which just so happened to be down the street from us where we lived. And there was always a sense of urgency. And my mother always said, you know, I need to get the money. I need to go see Jose. You know, that was a tradition. You know, every weekend her goal was simply to get to Jose before he spent all the money, because she knew we had to pay rent. She knew we had to pay light, gas. She had to provide food. You know, my mother was always in a mode of survival. And that sort of impressed upon us, you know, it really did impact us. You know, while other kids in the neighborhood were having nice clothing and nice bikes and other things, you know, we didn't have those things, you know. And it's funny because, you know, as much as my mother tried to, you know, sort of alleviate that, you know, it really just made it worse. Because whenever she would go to the bar and take the money from my stepfather, he would always come home in the middle of the night very angry and upset. He would kick down the door. He would break the television or break the windows. More often than not, he would break the windows and my mom didn't let him in. And that also caused a lot of conflict with the landlord, because the landlord didn't want to have to continue to return to fix the property. And so it was always just a very stressful situation. And
do you have siblings also?
I have two sisters, Melinda and Jennifer. I have a brother named Nathaniel. We were not that far in terms of age. We were all, my brother is just 1 year older than I am, and my sister, Melinda, is 1 year younger than I am. And my little sister, she's a few years apart, but she also, you know, had to experience that firsthand. And oftentimes, you know, when my mother would anticipate him coming, she would come in the middle of the night and she'll wake us up and say, let's go, Jose's coming. And for us, we knew what that meant. We knew that that meant to grab your shoes, grab your coat, don't grab nothing else, let's go, we're going out the back door. And the reason why that was the case is because if he caught us in the house, more often than not, he was going to hit my mother, beat us, and kick our dog. You know, like, that was his thing. He always would kick our dog because he knew that would hurt us. We had a dog named Rocky. I'll never forget the sound of our dog on the back porch just howling in pain, and he would keep kicking him and kicking him, and it was just traumatic all around, you know. But on the good nights, you know, strange enough, on the good nights, my mother would, you know, get us out the house in time. We would go, and unfortunately, oftentimes we had to roam the streets. She would go to a friend's house. We would sleep in their home. And it's funny because their homes are always better. You know, they had rugs, they had sofas, they had their own rooms, they had VCRs, they had cassette tape players. And we were always in awe. And it was almost like a treat to be able to be surrounded by such luxuries, you know. But for us, you know, it was always just a thought of what we're going to come home to. And when we would come home in the morning time, you know, oftentimes the house would be in shambles.
At the time, I mean, because, you know, I'm going to be thinking the same kinds of things some of our listeners are going to be, that, you know, you have four children in some very unstable, chaotic circumstances. Where are adults in their lives who might be aware of this, like teachers or, I don't know, social workers or neighbors? Or were these issues that ever were, like, addressed in school with you?
I mean, there were times when, for example, when I was 6 years old, my little sister, Jennifer, her father was also abusive. From what I was told, the school found out, and then my aunt found out about his abuse towards us. And my mother, because she was afraid of what would happen, was not quick to alert the authorities. But my aunt did. She did, you know. And when she did that, they came, and there was already documented signs of abuse, you know, because the schools were questioning what was going on with us. Oftentimes we would miss days in school.
Right.
And when we did come, we were always in shambles. And it just, you could just tell when a child's life, home life, is just not right. And when the police came, they came to arrest my stepfather. I'll never forget, they were knocking on the door. We lived on the third floor of the apartment building on a very busy street. And I remember looking out, you know, looking out the window, and we saw police cars, and the police were knocking on the door, and it got to a point where they were banging on the door. And I remember seeing my stepfather running into the bathroom. And so when he ran to the bathroom, my mother put the chain lock on the front door. I didn't know what was going on. We were all in there. We were crying because it just seemed like it was a very loud noise. People were trying to come in. We didn't quite understand what was happening. You know, I remember thinking to myself, like, there's no way you're going to get past that little latch. You know, like, we couldn't, you know, like, who could possibly get past that latch? You know, but strange enough, they were able to get past that latch. And when they opened that door, they told my mother, you know, we want to know where he's at right now. We know he's here. We saw him come in. My mother was crying. He's not here. He's not here. And when they came in, they found him hiding in the bathroom. They cuffed him up. They grabbed my mother also. They went downstairs. A woman came in. I'll never forget. She walked up to us and said, "Everything's going to be okay. Just please come with me." And we all walked down the stairs. We're all crying. And when we got to the bottom stairs, they asked us to get in the back of a squad car, you know, and I had never been placed in a police car before. I remember I'm 6 years old.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a very traumatic experience. And I remember seeing my mother fighting the police, just trying to wrestle with them, trying to stop them from taking us away. But within no time, we were driving away, and I saw her at a distance still fighting. But she became smaller and smaller as we drove away, and that was it. We went into the foster care system, wow. And we ended up going to a foster home, I believe on the west side of Chicago. We were supposed to be in a place that was, you know, nurturing, loving, and a sort of consolation away from the stresses that we had endured as children. Unfortunately, we're only met with more hostility and abuse from a foster mother who didn't believe in allowing us to have toys, who didn't believe in allowing us to have recreation, who was quick to pick up a belt or a hanger or something to hit us whenever she felt slighted or disrespected, or if we were simply too messy or noisy in her house. And she just really picked up where my stepfather left off, and it just didn't seem to be no ending to all that. And when we came out of foster care 2.5 years later, after much complaints and after my mother fought very hard to get us back, that's when we met the stepfather I spoke about a moment ago, Jose. And that's Jose. When we met him. Yes.
I mean, it's hard for me to wrap my head around the trauma that you and your siblings really survived. I mean, that sounds like you survived a childhood. You didn't really have a childhood so much. I want to move to the actual crime that you were convicted of and served so many years for. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened? You know, because first degree murder is pretty serious. How did you get involved in this?
By the time I was 11 years old, I joined the gang, and it was because of the environment. But I also think it was also because of the sort of emotional deficits that existed in my life, not feeling love within my home and just being really impressed, I guess, in so many ways, lured in by the gang culture.
Right.
I started making poor decisions very early on. And so for me at that age, at 11 years old, not having any, I would say, positive male role models, you know, I was really given to the gang life, because I saw the love and camaraderie. I saw the respect that they had. My friends, my closest friends, who were perhaps enduring similar struggles at home, were also given to that. And, you know, we started doing simple, small things that could have gotten us in big trouble. When you're a child, when you're 9, 10, 11, you know, you don't think about the consequences. And my very first arrest happened when I was 9 years old, and that's because I simply couldn't resist a candy bar in a grocery store. I tried to steal it. I got caught. I was handcuffed, taken to the police station. I was charged with theft. Soon after, I was locked up twice more for trying to take quarters out of parking meters. So just really silly things that I was doing as a kid, not really thinking about the consequences. By the time I was 11 years old, I already had racked up several offenses, and that was the same year that my best friend accidentally shot me in my face.
Okay, so we're going to talk about that, but for these other offenses like the candy bar and the parking meters, were you actually sentenced to serve any kind of time in juvenile detention, or what was the result of that?
My very first arrest was simply dealt with as a station adjustment. In Chicago, there's a point system. After so many arrests, you know, regardless of what they're for, if the point system reaches a certain point, then you automatically are eligible for detention. Well, it just so happened to be that I was eligible for detention when I lied to the police about who shot me in my face by accident, and that was my best friend. I didn't want to tell on my best friend, and they charged me with obstruction of justice. And because of that sort of accumulated points, 2 weeks after being out of the hospital, while still contending with a locked jaw, while still contending with a loss of hearing and the partial blindness in my left eye, I was placed in the detention center at 11 years old. And that was the very first time I was ever incarcerated.
And you lied to the police because it was your best friend. It wasn't intentional.
Yes.
Why did that happen?
Well, first of all, you know, we were kids. You know, we were playing with a weapon. We were told where the guns were. If we ever had any problems, you know, the older gang members, you know, told us where they were at. And like any other kid, you know, we're naturally risk-taking, impulsive. We don't think about what we're doing. And we grabbed the gun from underneath the porch and we were messing with it. And within moments, all I heard was boom, you know, and I was shot in my face. My friend panicked. He dropped the gun. They carried me to my other friend's house. His mother was hysterical. She was crying. I told you, you guys are messing around with these gangs. She automatically assumed that someone else shot me, and I didn't want to tell on my friend. So and I guess in so many ways, like, I just knew right then and there I was not going to tell on my friend. And when the police questioned me in the back of the ambulance, they asked me, they said, "Who shot you?" And at this time, I'm sort of coming in and out of consciousness. I'm bleeding profusely out of my mouth and my nose. I'm swallowing blood. I'm going through a lot of physical trauma. And in that moment, I just simply said, a man in a black car. And so when I said a man in a black car, they left immediately. They went through the neighborhood searching, trying to find a suspect. I mean, imagine, you know, a man in a black car shoots an 11-year-old kid in the face. Imagine the anger. Imagine the horror. You know, if that happened today, that would be all over the news, you know. And I think that's how they responded to it. But when they questioned one of the friends that was also there, he told the truth. And when he told the truth, they immediately arrested my friend. They charged him with attempted murder.
How old was he?
He was 13 years old. And I look back and I question what could have been done differently. You know, I think that as tragic as that situation was, you know, I think it would have been so much better had they recognized my victimization, had they recognized I was a child. And I don't think they saw that in me. I think they just saw this little kid, this little punk who's playing with a gun. You know, he's gang involved, he has prior arrests, he's a violent little kid, and this is what he gets. And when they saw that I wasn't being honest, they thought of a charge. I never heard of obstruction of justice. Those words flew over my head. I had to question, what does obstruction of justice mean? I was just trying to protect my friend. Like, I think any kid would try to do that. But that resulted in me being placed in detention. And unfortunately, it was downhill from there. I was in and out of detention over and over again. And when I was 12 years old, I got arrested for aggravated assault and a weapon charge. It was a gang-related incident. And the judge looked at me and said, I'm sending you to Maryville Academy. When they sent me to Maryville Academy, it was a group home. I was now, once again, you know, imagine my mother's nightmare, you know, of me being placed in the Department of Children and Family Services all over again. She lost me, you know, and
right. And
that was very hard for her to accept, you know, that here it is, you know, she tried so hard for so many years to keep us away from the system. And now I was once again a ward of the state. But in some ways, I think that was a positive opportunity. You know, the fact of the matter is that my mother, throughout all the violence with my stepfather, throughout all the abuse, my mother never called the police. Because she was always afraid that they would take us and put us back in the foster home. She thought she was doing the right thing, but all it really did was expose us to increasingly more dangerous situations. And by the time I was placed in Maryville Academy at the age of 12 years old, I have to admit, a part of me was relieved.
So how long were you in that group home?
I was there for a year. And it's strange because, you know, by the time I was 13, I had 19 arrests and 7 convictions. But for that year, that small pocket of time, I had no arrests. I was placed in a new environment. I was placed in an environment that allowed me to have my own room, an environment that allowed me to have my own bed. I never had my own bed. This was the first time I ever had my own bed. They taught me how to make my bed, you know, and I took pride in that. But what was hard to overcome, unfortunately, was the fact that I was still very much inclined towards gang activity. I still associated very strongly with the gang, and I literally would lay down and I would listen to music and I would fantasize about being back in my neighborhood. Because that's the only place I ever really truly felt accepted and loved, you know, and that's right. The only place that I really felt like I could be myself and that they would, you know, respect me. And I was always in some way waiting for the opportunity to have a good reason to run away. And that opportunity came in July of 1989. Not that I hoped for it necessarily, but it was just something that happened there that just sent me running away and I had vowed to never return.
So you returned to your neighborhood. What led up to the murder that you were arrested for?
Well, when I ran away from Maryville, I had nowhere to live. You know, my mother was afraid because the Department of Children and Family Services were after me. They were looking for me. They were also pending charges at Maryville because of the damage to property, the burglary to the home supervisor's office because we took money out of the trust fund account to take a taxi. So I had racked up some offenses before I left. And I knew that if I got caught, I would definitely go to the Department of Corrections because now I'm 13 years old. And within no time, I got arrested for aggravated assault on someone inside of a bar. It was a gang-related incident. It was a rival gang member, and they arrested me. They put me into the detention center, and I went before the same judge. The craziest thing happened. He said, you know, in so many ways, Xavier, you know, this is it. This is the end of the road. I've given you too many opportunities. And lo and behold, you know, look who walks into the courtroom. The home supervisor, Paul Volz. He was, he came to fight for me, and he got me out. But when I went to the front of the detention center, I ran away again. So now I'm definitely in trouble. And now I'm in the streets more often. I'm very much immersed in gang activities because it's all I have in my life. And the nights had grown much darker in the sense that, you know, oftentimes I was being shot at. Oftentimes I was being chased by rival gang members because I would oftentimes be one of the only ones remaining in the streets. When everybody else went home, I was still in the streets, you know, and I eventually started to go home more often. But even then, I was afraid because I lived on a borderline between my gang and a rival gang territory. I started bringing guns into my mom's house and she didn't know about it. It was just a very scary, a very paranoid and a very dark time of my life. And on one given night in my neighborhood, we saw someone coming around the corner, and I was on security, meaning that the older gang members had given me a gun to be on the lookout for rival gang members because we had been shot at the day before. When I saw him, and I alerted them, and when I alerted them, we approached him. And unfortunately, the situation unfolded in such a way that, in such an unfortunate and sad way that, you know, this kid lost his life, you know, and he was taken to an abandoned building. He was beaten to death. He was stabbed. He died a death that he didn't deserve, you know. And
do you know how old he was? It's okay. Take your time.
He was 14 years old. He was a year older than I was. And no, but you wouldn't have known that. I mean, he was much bigger than me. He was a big kid, you know. And I didn't find that out until a time after that. And we just simply thought he was a rival gang member. It was past midnight.
Right.
You know, and he was someone we didn't know. And it was a situation that really got out of hand. And I can't say it was within my control. You know, I was along with one of my co-defendants, you know, we were kids, you know, but unfortunately, you know, decisions were made and things did happen, and it resulted in the loss of his life. And by the time I had went into getting arrested for that offense, you know, I had tried my best to block it out. You know, it was, to me, even for me, it was a very traumatic experience. You know, it wasn't something that I had anticipated, but I was guilty. I never thought that anyone would be killed. I never thought anyone would lose their life. But leading up to that eventuality, unfortunately, that I wasn't very much involved and I was very responsible. Mm-hmm. And so after that happened, I remember running home and I cried. You know, I remember I was laying on my mom's couch and I kept praying, saying, God, forgive me. Please, God, forgive me. Forgive me. Like, I had never done or been a part of something so horrible. And as much as I prayed, as much as I tried to forget, I couldn't block it out of my mind.
When you were going to take the plea or took the plea for 25 years as a 13-year-old, right? Almost twice the number of years you've actually lived. Did you feel at that time like that you deserved it?
You know, when you're someone that has been told, you know, repeatedly that, you know, you are a bad person, you know, when you're told that over and over again, you know, I mean, I definitely felt like I deserved something.
You were released after serving 13 years. So you're 26 years old at this point. I'm sure there's so much to be said about those 13 years because you went from being a child to being an adult in that time. So first of all, were you in a juvenile detention center and then transferred to an adult detention center? How were you at all prepared to be released back into society after all those years?
The beginning of my time started in juvenile facilities. I was in the temporary juvenile detention center over in Cook County here in Chicago on the south side. When I pled guilty, I was sent to, it's called the Illinois Youth Center. And the Illinois Youth Center in Joliet was a maximum security prison for kids. It was there, and I guess sort of structurally in terms of the environment, it really was much like in a maximum security prison for adults. But actually, I was surrounded by other youth, and going from being in an environment that was mostly youth and kids my age, no older than 20, 21, and being thrown into the adult prison system at age 17 for my birthday, it was really just a giant leap forward in terms of my experience. I can't say I was prepared. I knew the stories. I had heard all the stories about what it was like to be in adult prison. I knew that it was much more dangerous. I knew that there were people getting stabbed, being killed, being raped, being exploited, taken advantage of. And for me at that young age, you know, the way I sort of internalized all that was for me to decide that I was not going to be one of those individuals. You know, I decided that at the age of 17, when I was going to the adult prison, that I was not going to be a victim and that I was going to stand up and I was going to fight for myself.
But when you say fight for yourself, you don't actually mean fight, because I know you did something really remarkable, which is earn a college degree in prison, right?
Like I said, that came years later. When I went to the adult system at 17, I have to be honest with you, you know, I wish I could say that it was an easy, smooth, and a very enlightening transition for me early on, but it was not that. It was me constantly hitting my head and getting in trouble and being thrown to solitary confinements, being placed in administrative lockdown over and over, and after having gone through that for the first year in and out of segregation and then being placed in a hole for a year for assaulting a correctional officer.
When you say placed in the hole, can you explain what that means?
So being placed in the hole is the same, people often refer to as isolation, solitary confinement. It's a time when you're being removed from the general population of inmates. You're being placed in the cell more often than not by yourself. More often than not, you don't have some of the things you would normally have. You have some basic necessities, you know, soap, you know, maybe shampoo and, you know, paper, pencil, books. But you don't have a lot of the clothing and other personal belongings that, you know, would typically be able to just distract you from that sense of deprivation. And most importantly, you're not able to talk with other inmates. You might be able to yell through the gallery. You might be able to communicate and sort of cry out for things that you might need to an officer or guys who are working the gallery. But for the most part, you're in the world all by yourself.
And you were there for a year.
Yes, I was in that situation in Pontiac Correctional Center for a year. And during that time, I just think I had a lot of time to reflect upon my life. You know, I was going on 18 years old, I came to realize that in Pontiac, you know, death row is just literally feet away. It's like 100 feet away from the segregation unit that I was housed in. I remember going to the yard oftentimes and we would be out there playing basketball because they would let us out of our cell like once or twice a week for 3 hours at a time just to meet their quota. They had to let us out at least for 1 hour a day, but because they couldn't do that, they would just bunch those hours up and they would let us out for periods of time throughout our stay there. And I would look across the walkway and there would be someone playing basketball by himself all the time. I didn't really think about it much, but then one day it just dawned on me and I thought to myself, like, you know, here it is. You know, I assaulted a correctional officer, but yet I'm still able to interact and mingle with other inmates. And I thought to myself, what could this individual have done to deserve being isolated, that even his yard periods are complete, you know, by himself? And he couldn't yell across the walkway, else he would get in trouble. And when I asked one of the old inmates, I said, look, you know, what's going on with that guy over there? Why is he playing basketball by himself? Why he's not over here with us? And I remember the guy telling me, he said, look, he's on death row. And I remember looking across the walkway and I looked at this guy's face and I didn't quite understand, you know, what he could have been thinking or feeling. I tried to read his facial expressions. I got nothing. I could not imagine that situation. But I felt very strongly that if I kept living the life that I was living, that I was going to end up there. And when I was in solitary confinement, I guess, you know, that sort of made me think and reflect. And I thought about the victim. I thought about the fact that he was not much older than me. You know, my mother was still contending with her problems at home. My brother was still contending with mental illness. My little sister had just joined the gang. I was getting all these very unfortunate communications through mail. It was just really weighing upon me. And I just realized, like, wait a minute, I can't do this. You know, a part of me just realized that this is just not who I am inside.
Did you know at that time that you were not going to serve 25 full years?
I knew that because when I was placed in segregation, I was given another year added onto my time. I was only in the adult system for a year, but during that year, I had already lost a year and a half. So in so many ways, I did my year for nothing because now I have that plus some added onto my time. And I didn't see that ending. I knew that if I continued on living like this, I was never going to get out of prison. It just dawned on me that I had to make some decisions. And so from there, that's when the change began. I started really to reflect upon things and I ended up getting out. I was able to stay out of trouble. I worked my way back into a medium security prison. I was able to take advantage of some programs. I did earn an Associate of Arts, an Associate's in General Education. I earned a bachelor's degree in social science, had a 4.0 GPA, was inducted into the Franklin Honor Society for outstanding scholarship, was really just excelling academically. And just really surrounding myself with other positive individuals who were incarcerated with me, I was able to create another positive peer group. And that, for the most part, were my fellow team members. I was on a boxing team. I started training other inmates how to box. But the discipline, I guess, the growing sense of maturity and remorse, a lot of things sort of played into it, along with the positive peers I was surrounded with, sort of enabled me to sort of go down a different trajectory in terms of my future outcome. I knew that when I came out of prison, I certainly didn't want to return.
It's such an incredible transformation that you're talking about. I'm assuming because you had been moved to a medium security that you were able to get certain educational opportunities that maybe people in other institutions wouldn't get. I know where Adnan is housed right now, he cannot earn a college degree.
Yeah.
So not everybody is afforded the same even opportunities in terms of education.
Well, in the mid-1990s, which was around a time when I was going to graduate, Clinton's crime bill did eliminate Pell Grant opportunities for inmates across the country. So I was very fortunate to be one of the individuals who was at the later half of completing my degree, and they did eliminate Pell Grants, but the Illinois Department of Corrections didn't want to let it go so easily. And so they were allowing us to take out loans. And so we took out loans, and I think it was two or three semesters. And from there, I was able to earn my bachelor's degree. But unfortunately, even that support sort of dwindled away. And now, you could be locked up for 20, 30, 40 years. And in some institutions, the highest level of education you would ever receive is a GED. And for those who are serving life or other extreme sentences, and those of whom, you know, that the administration may deem to be without hope in terms of their sentencing, may never be able to go into an academic setting at all.
Yeah. I know it's been a point of frustration for Adnan. He's earned every certificate available, and he's relatively young. He's learning, you know, serving a life sentence. He's only 34 right now. So it is a very long stretch ahead of him if he, you know, is not ever released, and if he can never take any kind of further programming. So I want to talk about when you were released. You came out of prison with a college degree. What did you do from there?
Well, when I came out of prison, I had to make some very hard decisions right away. I knew that if I went back to my old neighborhood, that, you know, I'll be faced with perhaps not temptation, but more or less having to be reminded of my past, having to deal with things that I may not want to have to deal with. And so when the prison counselor asked me about my parole release conditions, the first question was, do you have a place to live? And I chose to say that I had nowhere to live. And the reason why is because I was under the impression that if I said that I will be able to go to a halfway house in a different community away from where I grew up. I was just so traumatized from that experience. I didn't want to go back, and I didn't want to face my past in so many ways. I really just wanted to start anew and recreate myself and just start a new life. So when I came out of prison, they gave me an address. It was over by Belmont and Halsted on the north side of Chicago. I didn't know exactly what the place was, but when I arrived there, I remember I took a bus, and then I took a train. But when I arrived at this address, I was approaching it. It was early evening. And when I got there, it was a long line of people standing in front of the building. And I didn't know if that was where I should be. But then I looked at the address, I double checked it, and sure enough, this is where I was supposed to be. And when I walked in, I told them where I came from, who I was, and that I should be on a list to stay there. And when they told me, you know, yes, we have your information, you know, grab a mat, it was completely disillusioned at that moment to what my freedom would entail. I thought it would be easy. I thought I would be able to come out. It would be much better. But the strange and unfortunate reality is that my last night in was much better than my first night out, because I found myself sleeping next to a homeless person on a small blue mat with a sheet over my head. And I was in a homeless shelter. And that, for me, going from having a cell, having a bunk, having, you know, certain personal belongings, to having nothing at all and sleeping on the floor, it was not what I had expected, you know, right, coming out of prison. But that was just one of the earlier challenges. Eventually, I did give in. I decided to go back. I told my parole officer I want to live with my mother. And I went back to my old neighborhood. I was trying to find work. I was also trying to pursue a boxing career. You know, I went to Garfield Park. I started boxing. I was training. I was taking public transportation. So I was a bit, you know, anxious about, you know, going to certain neighborhoods. I knew that violence was present in my city, but I was just trying to think positive. And within 3 months, I went to the Golden Gloves. I participated in that. So I did see some positive things coming out, but I was also struggling financially. You know, when I came home, I went back to my own neighborhood, to the same poverty, the same struggle, the same hardship that my mother was contending with when I left, you know, and I felt very bad about that. And the fact that I had a bachelor's degree and that I was being denied, you know, repeatedly for work opportunities, it was a bit discouraging. I just knew I could not give up. You know, I saw many people coming back into prisons because they gave up, and I said, I'm not going to give up. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to volunteer my time. So I started volunteering.
Oh, wow. Okay. I was going to ask how you got your big break, but I see that you came up with a strategy that until and unless you get your big break, you're going to go. That's great.
I'm going to live the life that I envisioned no matter what, you know, and that's what I told myself. Whether I'm being paid for it or not, I know that I want to be able to reach out to youth. I knew coming out that I wanted to be able to help and at the very least train kids how to box. Like, that was my passion. And so I remember I went to the YMCA. I met with their street intervention team there. I came to find they had a heavy bag. They had some gloves, other mats, and certain things that I can use. And I said, you know, I can volunteer my time here. And if you allow me, I'll be very appreciative of that. And so they allowed me to come. And I was taking the Ashen bus to North Avenue, Rolandale. I would walk a few blocks. And there I was in a sort of oasis. You know, I didn't think about my struggles at home. I was there in the moment, working with the youth, trying to just really share with them, not just in terms of boxing skills, but my life experiences and trying to encourage them to do better things. And during that time, there was an outreach worker named Tolliver. Tolliver also became aware of my conviction history, and he saw my commitment, you know, and he said, you know what, I'm going to try my best to help you find work. And sure enough, you know, he contacted me. He said, look, I think I have a job for you. And my first job, you know, he spoke to the store manager at Starbucks, and he convinced her to give me a chance. And so my first real job out of prison was at Starbucks. I went from lockdowns to lattes, and my whole world changed. You know, and it's funny because when I had that job, you know, I thought to myself, well, I'm working part time. You know, I have all this extra energy from all these espresso shots. I might as well go ahead and go to school, you know. And I went back to Roosevelt University, which was the university that came to my previous institution and allowed me to get my bachelor's. And I signed up. Within a couple of years, I had earned my master's degree from Roosevelt University. I was really excited.
And you did this while you were working at Starbucks the entire time?
While I was attending Roosevelt University, I met a street intervention worker. It's funny because most of the people that gave me breaks were formerly incarcerated individuals. You know, Xavier Williams was someone who had served 20 years in prison. And I met him at Roosevelt University. And he said, man, you ever thought about being an outreach worker? I said, well, I mean, I volunteer my time. I would love to have that opportunity, but I'm working at Starbucks and it's fine with me. You know, I was not driven for money. I never really was driven for money coming out of prison. I was just really just trying to survive and live out a positive life. I just really wanted a normal and positive existence. I never had that in my entire life. Right. And for the first time, I was able to live a normal and positive existence. And I think that was the most rewarding thing of all, coming out of prison. And when he told me about this opportunity to work for Ceasefire, I took it and I went, I interviewed with them. And then I was able to start working in Logan Square. At that time, B-1413 had one of the worst homicide rates in our city. We were able to come in and intervene in the lives of kids who were very much immersed in gang life and were getting in trouble. And we were able to work with them through case management, going to their schools, going to the courts, advocating for them, addressing certain needs in their lives, and really just being a mentor and a positive role models in their lives. And because of that, we were able to go from being the very worst within the city to having zero homicides in our beat. I just really saw that it is possible to address the needs of these children, to address violence. And so I was really driven for that. And I went from Ceasefire to working with Catholic Charities. And once again, I was now doing similar work, but in my community where I grew up. And that was a very interesting, very challenging, but very interesting and rewarding experience, because I was able to work with the kids of my old, you know, gang partners. You know, I was able to, on the same streets that I once hung out on.
What was it, can I ask you, what was it like for your family and gang members and people that you grew up with who knew you? How was it for them to see this transformation with you? Was it inspiring to them? Was it threatening to them? Was it challenging for them? How did they react to this?
They were the most supportive people in my life, you know? And of course, you know, your family's gonna be very supportive. And I remember they would come out to events. My sister one time came out and supported a community event, and she was helping passing out stuff to kids. And they really just embraced my work. And then, you know, strange enough, people, you know, I think oftentimes people misunderstand outreach. You know, I was doing a lot of things that were perhaps unorthodox, but it's because I understood the environment. I understood that in order for me to reach the kids, I have to be able to talk to these gang leaders. I have to be able to empower them in a different way. I have to be able to sort of leverage those relationships to provide opportunities and resources to the kids that, for the most part, would have been unreachable. But just given that ability to go back into my old community and use my, not the bad reputation, but the positive outcome of Speedy, of Xavier, to sort of reinforce this sort of very positive image of themselves as well and what they're capable of, I think really helped. And because of that, we were able to broker, I wouldn't say peace treaties, but understandings. You know, they knew that they were not to mess with certain school grounds. They knew that on this day we'll be out having a barbecue and there'll be no alcohol allowed. They knew that if they were respectful enough not to mess with Second Chance High School, we'll be able to take them to Magic Waters, Great America, you know, just do Six Flags and just do things that And a lot of them never had the opportunity to do, but because of that reward system, we're able to reinforce a lot of positive behavior. And by them seeing me and others, not just myself, but others in that capacity, I just think that it really was able to reinforce within them a different sense of purpose and meaning and what they're capable of and doing in terms of their own lives. And so that was a very rewarding time in my life as well.
Right now you work with an organization that is based out of D.C., right?
Yes.
I want to talk a little bit about this organization. It's called the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. Can you tell us a little bit about it, how you began working with them and why you began working with them and what they do?
So after working with Captain Cherry's Extreme Intervention Specialist, I went on to work for Alternatives as a Juvenile Justice Diversion Program Coordinator. I was able to do restorative justice practice with kids and sort of helping them reflect upon their lives, fulfill community service hours, and sort of, you know, get over some of the past mistakes that they made. And from there, I ended up going to work with Northwestern University. I was working with a research study called the Northwestern Juvenile Project. It was a longitudinal study that looked at the mental health needs and outcomes of formerly incarcerated youth. And for the most part, we were just looking at their outcomes. We were looking at risk factors, you know, the sort of risk-taking behaviors that manifested, unfortunately, you know, for some of them, you know, incarceration, for some of them, you know, STDs, for some of them, mental illness, a lot of things that they had endured. The trauma really manifested itself in a very devastating way for a lot of them. But there were also some very positive outcomes. There were individuals who were homeowners, business owners. They were, you know, hard workers, family men, good fathers, you know, wonderful sons, and just very supportive people in their community. And so I was able to see both sides. You know, I was able to see what was possible and what wasn't possible in terms of outcomes for kids going into the system young and coming out as adults. And of course, it helped me to understand my life and how, you know, I'm not the exception to the rule. There are so many people out here in our society who had endured similar upbringings, had made similar mistakes, had suffered similar consequences, but had changed. But I also recognized that there were some systemic challenges that existed for many of them coming out. And that really impressed upon me the desire to want to advocate. But what really hurted me the most was the fact that some of them were still in prison. Mm. A lot of the people that I knew growing up, you know, in the system, coming out, having started a career, earned a master's, you know, being able to be with my family, to recreate myself and sort of reinvent who Xavier was. Unfortunately, many people with that same potential were still in prison. And I remember it was December 2013, a New York Times article came out about our project. It sort of featured my story. It talked about the work that I was doing. And I was contacted by Shoba Mahadev, who worked with the Illinois Coalition for Fair Sentencing of Children. And this was the Illinois Coalition that was addressing extreme sentencing and sort of trying to fight back and scale back those sentencing schemes that were, for the most part, in the eyes of many, including myself, very inhumane. And I got an email from her asking me if I'd be willing to meet with her. And that she read my story, that it resonated much with the work that they were trying to do across the country, as well as in our state. And when I met with her, I came to find that there was a movement that existed. It was a movement that was trying to end life without parole for children. And I remember the people that I was locked up with that were serving these sentences. And it just really made me think about, you know, the fact that, you know, here it is, you know, 25 years later, and this is still happening. And then I was also contacted weeks later, and she said, Xavier, you know, how would you feel about going to Los Angeles to do a PSA? And that may sound funny, but I was like, what is a PSA?
Yeah.
It's funny because, of course, I knew what a public service announcement was, but I had never been asked to do such a thing. And they explained to me that there was a film that was coming out and that this film was really talking about the mandatory sentencing schemes in the federal system, but that it also relates much with the extreme sentencing of children. And they want to share my story and for me to give my input about, you know, what does it mean to have a second chance? And so I decided to go. I went to Hollywood. It wasn't what I thought I would be. I thought I'd see a bunch of stars walking around, but instead I saw a bunch of stars on the floor with a lot of movies. But that was a wonderful experience because, you know, I had, at that time, that was only the second time I'd ever been on a plane. And it really just made me feel like I was doing something important for those who I had left behind. And I embraced this mission. And after volunteering for some time and just really sharing my story, eventually my job with Northwestern was coming to a close because of funding issues. And as I came to a close, I started to alert people that I was, you know, advocating alongside. And Jody Kent-Levy, who was the director of the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, you know, approached me and said, look, Xavier, we would love to have you on board. We don't quite have the funding right now because we've already created our budget for this year, but I want to do whatever I possibly can to bring you on board. And I remember her getting it approved with the board, you know, the CFSY board, to take money out of a place that was intended to be allocated towards other general operating activities. And they brought me in, and I found myself traveling the country, speaking to legislators, speaking to policymakers, judges, attorneys, speaking to, you know, heads of organizations. And I was really just thrown out there to just really be myself and really amplify the fact that children can change, and that has evolved in so many ways. And through that work, I was able to partner with other formerly incarcerated youth, other leaders, you know, the likes of Ralph Brazil, Eric Alexander, Sarah Kuzan, you know, some of the founding members of a national network that we created to help amplify the stories of formerly incarcerated youth, but also to educate the public, help change the narrative of formerly incarcerated youth.
That's the Incarcerated Children's Advocacy Network?
Yes. And so the Incarcerated Children's Advocacy Network was inaugurated in April 2014. It came about through the strategic efforts of the campaign, along with the founding members who were all formerly incarcerated. These individuals were leaders in their own right. You know, I often say, ICANN does not create leaders. They were leaders when they came. Many of them were certified in violence prevention, were counselors, had headed, you know, YMCA programs, were mentors in their community, were business owners, you know, working, you know, in jobs that you had never imagined. But what we all had in common were two things. All our members were either convicted of homicide-related offenses as children, or were once given life without the possibility of parole. And for those who were given life, you know, them being free now today, you know, was a result of other legal interventions, whether it was a commutation, exoneration, a pardon, some form of legal intervention that enabled them to come out. And with the U.S. Supreme Court decisions, in particular Graham and Miller, we saw more folks coming out who were once given life without parole, and they became a part of our national network. And so we've grown now. Today we have 40 members from 18 states, a racially diverse group of men and women who were all, you know, once deemed as the worst of the worst. But now here it is. They are some of the most remarkable, compassionate, caring people I've ever known.
Yeah, no, I had the pleasure of meeting some of them last year at the fundraising gala for CFSY. And, you know, I wanted to stop and talk a little bit about the issue of life, because it seems like, you know, for the campaign, this is like the seminal issue. It is not just fair sentencing, but specifically stopping life sentence without parole for youth. Am I right about that?
Yeah, so the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth is a clearinghouse and national collaboration that focuses exclusively upon ending life without parole for children. That is our sole purpose in terms of what we do across the nation. And that plays out in different ways. We have a legal team, we have an advocacy team, we have directly impacted folks, whether they were victims of violence or the loved ones of those who are currently serving or formerly incarcerated youth. We're all sort of a part of this robust coalition that's really intended upon trying our best to address extreme sentencing. And we go about this more intensely during the legislative session. We go to the ICANN members and the advocacy team, go to states speaking with legislators, testifying before legislative committees. It's really partnering with local folks there and trying to bring home the realization that children are different. That is one thing that we hold dear to, and that is the fact that, yes, you know, many children have been convicted of very serious offenses, you know, but at the same time, we also recognize that children are developmentally different. You know, we know that the prefrontal cortex wasn't formed within myself at the age of 13 years old. You know, I didn't know that at the age of 13 that, you know, my brain was still going through a process of pruning and myelination, that yeah. I was more emotionally driven, that I was more so guided by the limbic system, the amygdala, which sought out rewards and was naturally making us inclined towards risk-taking, impulsive, impetuous, you know, decisions. Like, I didn't know that about myself.
I think as a child and even a teenager, I mean, very few people are cognizant of this, but certainly the neuroscience on this has driven, you know, some of the changes, especially in the cases from the Supreme Court, that prove and show that a child's brain is not fully developed and the decision-making skills are very poor. And, you know, honestly, though, I mean, just from a common sense perspective, all many of us have to do is just remember what it was like to be 12 or 13.
Yeah.
And how, you know, do you remember what it was like? And would you trust yourself then, you know, with even like any kind of adult responsibilities? And of course not. So we all kind of know this, but it's really tragic that the criminal justice system doesn't really quite fully recognize this. In the state of Maryland, the ACLU just recently filed a lawsuit to address the fact that juveniles here are people who have been incarcerated since, you know, since they were children, who've gotten life sentences. And many of them will have life sentences with parole, but they're never actually granted parole.
Yeah.
So effectively, it becomes a life without parole. So, for example, none of these people have been granted parole in the last 20 years. Not a single juvenile offender has been granted parole who is serving a life sentence in 20 years. So this lawsuit seeks to bring changes based on, you know, the Supreme Court rulings on this. And right now, there are about 200 such individuals who would be impacted by this decision in Maryland.
Yeah.
And Adnan would naturally be one of them. Also, because yes. He was 17 at the time of the crime. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about is this, is that I think it might come as a surprise for a lot of people that you have, you know, children. I mean, not just people who are like 17 on the cusp, of me, but children, 12, 13, 11, yeah. who are sentenced like adults. How does yes. this happen?
What I become very much aware of is that, you know, many of us, and I'm not the exception to this, had endured very horrific upbringings. You know, if you look at the population of those who are currently serving life without parole since childhood, we know that 80% of them have witnessed violence on a weekly basis. You know, 54% were physically abused by their caretakers, whether it was a parent or a foster mother. Many of them were transient or homeless. You know, 20% were sexually abused and had been sexually exploited as children prior to their offense. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the women, the young girls who were given these sentences, more than 79% had endured sexual abuse, had been raped, had endured such things that, you know, a lot of us can hardly imagine. But unfortunately and sadly, by the time these traumas had manifested themselves through their own poor decisions and mistakes, the courts had already pegged them as monsters, as super predators, as individuals who would never change. But of course, we know now more than ever that that's not the case, that a child's worst decision and mistake should not define them. There are so many individuals who I know today, when you sit next to them, you know, even for myself, understanding, I've grown up in the system, but even I myself at times am blown away at the level of humanity that I see that exudes from their nature, from their being. And you just know in your heart that there's so many more people in there who are serving these sentences that just don't belong there.
Right.
You know, people who have been there for so long that they can hardly even remember why they're there in the first place. You know, and that's the sad reality. That one day they're going to wake up in the cell, look in the mirror, and to see an aging face, and know in their heart of hearts that they're not the same person. You know, that sad reality, that existential nightmare, unfortunately, is being played out across the country for so many people who have changed. And unfortunately, unless we do something about it, they will never know what it's like to live a normal life. They will never know what it's like to be able to be freed up so they can give back and sort of live out the eternal apology that many of us have been afforded, but unfortunately, many of them have not.
I do want to ask you about the families of victims and victims' rights groups. What has the response been from them? Because obviously, this is going to be a very difficult issue for them to grapple with.
You know, it's funny you asked me that question, because I think what I want to help share through this is something that's very personal to me. It was about a month ago I received an email. This was like days after my story was featured in a WGN report, which is a Chicago news on Channel 9 here. Most people watch it, and when they saw it, I got a lot of communication from many people across the city, really just encouraging me and our campaign to continue on the work that we're doing. But one email that I did receive, I did not expect. The first thing that it said was, "Hi, you know, my name is Cynthia Alonzo. I am one of Pedro Martinez's sister. Pedro Martinez is a victim in my case. She and her family had saw. They saw the WGN segment, and when I read that, my heart dropped. You know, like, I've always been working alongside people who have been impacted by violence. I've always been a strong, you know, advocate for those who have experienced those things, because I always think about the victim in my case. I've always been very vocal about the hurt and pain that I imagine I had caused his family, and how sad and regretful I am of the things that I did as a child. But I never expected to be reached out to, and I never thought that I would hear from a family member of Pedro. And when that happened, the next sentence, you know, was what really, really moved me. She said, you know, she said, "We have been following you.
Wow.
We've been following you. We've been following you. And and we like what you've done with your life." And when I read that, I broke down in tears. Because I never thought that I would meet a family member, but also I just could not, you have to understand, you know, he died in a very unfortunate and a very bad way, you know, and to read that, you know, really reaffirmed within me the humanity that we all possess, you know, the fact that people do recognize that children are different, you know, and this is not just playing out in the courtroom, it's not just playing out in our legislators, it's not just playing out and our parole boards. You know, we have people who have been impacted by violence, who've lost loved ones. And they're saying kids are different. We love what we see, what's possible, the potential that exists, the unlimited potential for these individuals to come out and start a new life. The penitence that we all carry, you know, and want to, you know, to give to the world. You know, I do things, I can't even turn down a homeless person when I'm at a stoplight, because I just know in my heart that I'm so responsible and I have so much to make up for. And I just think that when we often see or hear the voices of victims, unfortunately, I believe that can be misconstrued. I believe that there are so many people who have lost loved ones that do care, that are compassionate, that do want to see change, that do want to see not just people who coming out of prison have an opportunity, but to help prevent these things from happening. And so I think that in so many ways, when we think about victims, unfortunately, they tend to be portrayed in the media as a group of individuals who simply want vengeance. And many, I would just say many individuals who have lost loved ones, I think ultimately they just really want healing. They really want restorative healing.
Did you write her back?
Yes. I have to be honest, I didn't respond the same night. I was just, moved by the whole situation. And I thought about it. I thought about how delicate the situation was. I knew that this was an opportunity not just to apologize, but to hopefully bring healing into their lives. Like, I knew that I wanted to do that. When I responded by calling. Well, first I sent a text message because she provided her number and email. And when I called, she had her husband hop on the phone because her English was broken. Well, I come to find that her English isn't quite as bad as she thinks it is. But she's shy about it, so she always gets a translator. But it was through that initial conversation that I was able to share things that I had kept bottled in me for so long, you know. And going through that, you know, just getting to know her, you know, it's strange because it's only been a month and a half. And, you know, I come to find that she's one of the strongest supporters I have. You know, she's someone that's consistently supportive and encouraging, just constantly sending me smiling faces and words of motivation, just motivating me to continue on in the fight that I'm doing, sending me Bible verses, just really touching my life in a way that I never imagined. And I constantly say, you know, I cannot apologize enough. And a part of me feels like I don't deserve it. And I know in some ways, I know that this is great, serving a greater purpose. Right. And because of that, I'm just really allowing God to take this wherever he wishes to take this. And learning about Pedro, getting to know him through her, you know, has really, really impacted my life. You know, I came to find that his life wasn't much different from mine. You know, he had hardships growing up. You know, he had been in situations that in the streets with older gang members, in situations that he was exploited or really just taken advantage of in some ways. And much like me, he's just seeking out rewards, trying to be accepted and loved by his peers. And I also came to find that he was not a gang member. You know, he was not involved in a gang.
I've read and heard that you have dedicated your work to his memory. And I think that is remarkable. Your story is remarkable. And also the generosity of spirit and the forgiveness of his family and for her, his sister, to reach out. I mean, I can't imagine like how validating that must feel for you and how healing that must have been. I want to end with one last question for you. What do you think should have been done when you were standing in front of the judge at the age of 13 instead of what happened?
I think we're obviously talking about 25 years later. I mean, what we know today in terms of adolescent development was not existing. That knowledge was not existing at that time. But I just think that, you know, had I never been transferred into the adult system, you know, I would have been afforded much more opportunities much earlier in my life to have a positive socialization. It was not too late. Not only do we know that children's brains are informed, but that there is a plasticity that is there. That children are very much susceptible to change, that if given a proper support and positive environments, that they can change. And it doesn't have to be later on in life. It doesn't have to be when you're an adult. I think the moment that a child is met with a positive reinforcement system, the moment that he is embraced with love and compassion, the moment he is accepted, respected unconditionally, and really just regarded, I think that there's ample opportunities there for that child to just change his life. But it wasn't until many years later for me that I met a public defender that was compassionate, that did see me for who I was, that looked past my offenses and recognized that I was just a child, that I did have potential for change. And I would say very generally that if a court looks at a child and recognizes that simply is a child, and think about how you would want your child to be treated that would provide proper guidance on how to go about addressing and holding this child accountable, and most importantly, helping to create a very positive and nurturing environment that will enable him to have a positive outcome rather than reinforcing the negativity, rather than re-traumatizing and re-abusing and reinforcing a lot of the negativity that was there prior to that offense. Instead, I think we should be, you know, the first line of defense. We should be the ones to say, okay, you know what? This is a horrible thing you've done, Xavier. But we also want to give you a chance to make amends, to give you a chance to prove that you're better. We're not going to throw you away forever. We're going to give you a sentence that will be, it's not going to feel good. But at the same time, it'll be an opportunity for you to demonstrate your better self. And it may not come right away when we recognize that, but we're going to give you ample opportunities to change and become a better person. And we're not going to discard you forever. We're not going to ignore what we know in terms of adolescent development. We're not going to ignore what we know in terms of even international conventions that have said very clearly that you are different. You know, it's sad because we are the only country in the world that does this. You know, you look at the Convention on the Rights of the Child and other conventions, you know, international conventions that really try to protect children. You know, we know that some things are very common. Certain rights are very important. We know that, you know, every child should have clean water, food, you know, should have, you know, housing, a quality education, should not be exposed to hazardous working conditions. We know that children should be afforded, every human being should be afforded certain rights to protect the integrity and dignity of their existence as human beings, and in particular, with special recognition to their childhood. We should not treat children in an inhumane way. And so if you look at the Convention on the Rights of the Child in Article 37, it says, no child should be subjected to torture or other cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment or punishment, either capital punishment or life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, without the possibility of release, shall be imposed for offenses committed by persons below 18 years of age. We know in so many ways that children are different. We recognize this, you know, through other things, and, you know, that we forbid them from doing. We don't allow them to get married at a, you know, until a certain age. We don't allow them to drive. You know, we don't allow them to get into certain contracts or to smoke cigarettes or buy alcohol. We recognize that children are naturally impulsive, risk-taking, and very, you know, impetuous at times in life, and particularly in adolescence. But the moment that they commit that horrible mistake, sadly, in our society, is the moment that we throw all that out of the window. It's the moment that we relieve ourselves of our responsibility as adults to ensure that they can have a positive upbringing, to ensure that they are regarded as children and not to be treated as the worst of the worst adult offenders, but that, in fact, to be allowed to have restorative opportunities, to be able to take advantage of programming, to take advantage of therapy, to take advantage of things that can help guide them in a positive trajectory, so that they, much like us, like much like the many ICANN members across the country, have demonstrated that we are better than our worst act. And I think that's what I think the court, not just for myself, but for others who have made horrible mistakes as children, they should be given the same opportunities. And with that opportunity, I am very confident that many, if not all, and I cannot account for everyone's actions, but I would say the majority of people that I know, that I grew up with, and who I'm now connecting with through this national network, I know, you know, have really gone above and beyond to prove, not just to me, but society, their loved ones, their community as a whole, they are not horrible monsters. They're just simply individuals who made mistakes when they were children.
There are many lessons to be learned from Xavier's story, and one of them should be this. He is not alone. American prisons hold over 2,500 people who have been there since childhood, sentenced to life and sentenced to die there, one of whom happens to be Adnan. According to Amnesty International, the U.S. is the only country in the entire world that routinely sentences children to life without parole. Life sentencing of children is permitted in 43 states in the United States, even though the Supreme Court here has found that mandatory life sentencing of youth violates the Eighth Amendment as cruel and unusual punishment. It's time for us as a society to decide if our priority is to punish at all costs or to rehabilitate and heal. I hope Xavier's story moves you to take action and support the work of the campaign ICANN, and other organizations who strive to bring some humanity back to the criminal justice system. You can find out more about their work on their website, fairsentencingofyouth.org, and we'll also post the site as well as pictures and videos of their work on our website at undisclosed-podcast.org. You can also continue to follow Xavier's work along with ICANN and the campaign's work by finding him on Facebook. ICANN, again, it's the Incarcerated Children's Advocacy Network, has a Facebook page. And if you request to join it, Xavier himself will personally add you. Now, lastly, in just a couple of weeks, the campaign is going to be sponsoring an exciting event at the historic Lincoln Theater in D.C., a concert for justice, aptly called Justice Aid. I plan on being there, and so will Xavier and his team from the campaign. So come and join us as we promote justice through the arts. You can buy tickets at justiceaid.org, but hurry, because they are limited. A week from now, we'll be back with another special episode, and this time it will have a connection to season 2 of Serial. After all, criminal justice isn't just for civilians. The military has its own code of justice. Next time on Undisclosed. Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Audio production by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of the podcast Crime Writers On. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.